Welcome to The Roundup, a North Queensland-based podcast with regional content for regional clinicians. I'm Alyssa Hathaway, a GP and family planning clinician and head of JCU's clinical school here in Mackay. This collaborative podcasting project between North Queensland Regional Training Hubs, JCU, and our local regional hospital and health services will bring you a different regionally relevant podcast each fortnight. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands where we meet today, who were the original providers of healthcare in this region. In today's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Kim Forrest, who joins us from the Cairns region. Hi, Kim.
Hello. Thank you for having me back.
So that's right, Kim. We were really excited to have you talk about migraine to us previously. As a neurologist who works in the public sector, Parkinson's is another issue that comes up frequently in your practice, I imagine. We're really excited to talk about Parkinson's disease with you today.
Yeah, I am just as excited to talk about it.
So, Kim, Parkinson's disease, how prevalent is it?
It is the second most common neurodegenerative disorder in the world, so after Alzheimer's, so pretty prevalent. It's up there. And we go in neurology clinics, it is the main reason that people come in under the neurodegenerative banner as well. So that makes up, people seeing people with Parkinson's makes up the majority of my practice. And even then, I'm not seeing everybody that I can see in far North Queensland.
No, that's right. So then for most patients, Parkinson's disease is an idiopathic process. Are there some risk factors that we need to be mindful of?
That can be controversial is not quite the word. I think the jury is in and out and in and out on that one. So as far as idiopathic Parkinson's disease go, yes, there are about 10% pure monogenic genetic, but as for the other 90%, it's due to a number of, it's that old chestnut of a little bit of genetics, a little bit of lifestyle, but we still can't comfortably tell people to avoid certain things or to conversely do certain things in their lives to prevent Parkinson's disease.
Okay, so then if we can't do much to avoid it, how are we best going to identify these patients in the community? How can we keep it simple?
It's just keeping an idea. I guess it's just looking for it, being aware that it is very common, it does exist, and to just have in mind a picture in your mind of what the typical person with Parkinson's or how they present. Talking about, I guess, we're talking in the GP setting, so, this is where it's from the GP setting, but as a neurologist, I get my referrals that we all get our referrals from. So I'm very heavily reliant on the good sense and acumen of the local GPs on picking this up. And, yes, how do we keep it simple in diagnosing? Well, once you've seen a few people with Parkinson's, with the cardinal features of Parkinson's, it's hard not to see it. So this is difficult to do, obviously, on a podcast. I can't do it to show you anything. But we all know the quintessential picture. So this is a person who's, in their late 50s, 60s or 70s. They have a gradual onset asymmetric bradykinesia, so that's slowness of movement, arresting tremor, so a tremor that's worse when the limb is not being used, particularly the other upper limb, and rigidity, which is that resistance to passive movement, irrespective of posture and velocity. So I can diagnose, and most neurologists will say this as well, you can diagnose Parkinson's before the person has walked into your clinic and is sitting down next to you talking. They're the person who's sitting there in the waiting room with, depending on the stage of the condition, hypomimic faces, so that decreased range of facial expression, sometimes a decreased blink rate. They've got one hand that's tremoring at rest, a little bit slow to get up, slightly hunched, stooped posture. Again, depending on how advanced the condition is, a shuffling gait, difficulty getting through the doorway, that's where the shuffling can sometimes get a bit worse. And then that's it. So it's almost done. It can be almost done and dusted by the time the person sits down and starts talking with you about their symptoms.
Of course. So then if it's not idiopathic Parkinson's disease, Kim, what is it going to be?
Yeah, well, believe it or not, there's only a couple of differentials. So I guess the way to think about it is rule it in the first place. So think about that quintessential typical picture of someone with Parkinson's disease, and more often than not, it will be. But then there's a few relevant features that will make you think, maybe this isn't Parkinson's disease. So really the ones that you're thinking about is if somebody has early prominent, so very obvious, cerebellar dysfunction, autonomic dysfunction, if they've got a dementing illness or dementia, if you're up with your neurological examinations, things like cortical sensory loss and idiomotor apraxia, early falls or bulbar or respiratory involvement as well. They're the things that will make you think, oh, this looks like Parkinson's, but it's probably not. And so then if you've got these in mind, then that will lead you towards thinking about the key differentials for Parkinson's. So the main one is actually essential tremor, which is very common as well. The key features with that, of course, is an essential tremor is almost perfectly symmetrical in most cases. It's an action tremor, so it's a tremor that's worse when you're using your limbs and improves on rest, tends to come on a little bit earlier in life. As a broad example, when you're thinking about the tremor, if there is a little bit of question about whether or not someone's tremor is, because sometimes you can have both a resting and action tremor in Parkinson, and sometimes you can have a resting and action tremor in essential tremor, annoyingly, confusingly, but that tends to be for the condition. So it's all about which tremor is more prominent. And you can tease that out in examination, but often I find the most easy way to tease that out is to just ask them, what about the tremor bothers you, or how does the tremor affect you? And people, more often than not, an essential tremor, which is of course worse with action, it's an action tremor, people will say things along the lines of, I spill my coffee in the morning, I can't put on my makeup, I can't do fine motor tasks anymore. The tremor of Parkinson's disease, it's just bothersome to know it's there, it's socially embarrassing, or their partner sitting next to them going, I don't like them having it. So there's that real key difference. As far as other differentials go, it's a short list. You think about drug-induced Parkinsonism. So Parkinson's type symptoms, the motor symptoms, but are due to a long-term or even relatively short-term use of a dopamine blocking agent. So the key culprits are usually long-term antipsychotics and valproate too. Vascular Parkinsonism, which tends to be a lower limb Parkinsonism, can be a controversial diagnosis as well, but occurs in the setting of sort of chronic, moderately severe, small vessel ischemic change on the brain. And then, of course, the group of Parkinson's plus syndromes that we may or may not have all heard of. So that includes progressive supranuclear palsy, PSP. There's MSA, which is multiple systems atrophy. There's corticobasal syndrome, CBS, and dementia with Lewy bodies. So they're ones to think about. So that's what these warning features that I noted earlier are about. And if you have some of these features, in addition to what looks like the motor features of someone with Parkinson's disease, then they may or may not push you towards these alternate diagnoses. So for example, if someone is falling very early on in the course of their condition due to imbalance, if they've got strikingly symmetrical motor symptoms, plus or minus cognitive impairment, we tend to be thinking a bit more towards PSP, progressive supranuclear palsy. They also have an eye movement disorder. So the key is in the name, progressive supranuclear gaze palsy. So that inability to look down, but it's such a late feature that it's really not useful as a discriminating feature early on in the course of someone's condition, whether it be Parkinson's or PSP. Multiple systems atrophy. So you tend to think that if someone's in front of you, they look a bit, they look like they've got motor features of Parkinson's, but they've also got striking disproportionate autonomic dysfunction. So we're thinking about severe postural hypotension is the main one. Early satiety as well. The other feature of MSA that can be there is cerebellar dysfunction too. Think about myoclonus and alien limb dyspraxia. It's a bit of that's super rare, corticobasal. So don't worry too much about picking up on those. And dementia with Lewy bodies is probably the other key differential. And that's really, this is the one that can get people tricked up, because Parkinson's disease longitudinally can feature in 80% of cases dementia or cognitive impairment to a certain extent. But the key is the chronology. It should not occur early on with the motor symptoms in Parkinson's disease. Whereas dementia with Lewy bodies, there's a few more key differences between them, but essentially, if you're comparing it directly, you know, black and white to Parkinson's disease, dementia with Lewy bodies has dementia early on with a bit of Parkinsonism, and that dementia characterizes the condition and is much more striking and obvious and debilitating than the Parkinsonism.
Holy cow, Kim Forrest, we've talked about a lot of stuff already. So Parkinson's disease. So Parkinson's disease is the second most prevalent neurodegenerative disease in the world, of course, after Alzheimer's. The risk factors are genetic, but there's possibly an influence of lifestyle factors, pesticide exposure, drugs of abuse, that kind of thing. Particularly for Parkinson's, we're looking for that resting tremor, the rigidity, the bradykinesia from the late 50s onwards, thinking about also that classic Parkinsonian expression, those Parkinson's faces, the shuffling gait, particularly at doorways. And then in our differentials, we're thinking about a central tremor, which is a symmetrical tremor. If we're wondering about dementia with Parkinsonism, if the dementia precedes the Parkinsonism, then it's most likely primarily a dementia process. There can be drug-induced Parkinsonism potentially, particularly rather those long-term antipsychotics and sodium valproate. And then those Parkinson's plus syndromes, which are terrifying and most likely the domain of neurologists like yourself, but particularly that Lewy body dementia is going to have that fluctuating cognitive picture with hallucinations. So having thought about all of those things, Kim, do I start some medication straight up, or do we need to confirm the diagnosis with a neurologist first? Because getting my patients in to see a neurologist is really tricky.
It is, isn't it? So I encourage, because in the majority of cases, Parkinson's disease is easily recognisable and it does take a long time to get in to see a neurologist, starting medications in the GP setting is absolutely encouraged. So that's to answer that question. Yeah, don't wait for a neurology appointment. And in fact, just as a side note, that can help us with the diagnosis if eventually they get to see us and they have developed features that are suggesting that perhaps this isn't Parkinson's disease, that it might be one of the other disorders. Then, in fact, a trial of levodopa can be very helpful in distinguishing between Parkinson's disease and these other conditions that I mentioned, in that if someone has Parkinson's disease, they will respond in their bradykinesia and rigidity plus or minus tremor to the levodopa. So you're doing us a favour too. From the diagnosis, though, helping diagnostically, what it really boils down to, and whether or not you should institute any treatment, particularly medications for people with Parkinson's, is whether or not the symptoms are bothering the patient enough to do something about it. So if they are, you know, if someone is finding they can't use their right arm as well as they used to, they're having to modify how they go about their daily business, then absolutely, yes, there's no reason not to start it. It's important to know when you, and I'll go into the medications in a moment, but before I dive in, talking a bit more about the specifics of the medications, I've got to dispel a rumour that still sticks around all these years after it's been dispelled, which is that, so there was thinking for a long time there that you should put off starting levodopa which is the prodrug of dopamine, which is the neurotransmitter that's depleted in Parkinson's disease. It was a thought that we should hold off on levodopa treatment for as long as possible because of the fear that levodopa could actually accelerate the condition of Parkinson's by way of at a neuronal level. It can accelerate the dying off of the presynaptic neurons in the striatum. This has been absolutely refuted. And in fact, we're starting to think the other way. If you think about it, if you start the medications earlier, or when the symptoms of Parkinson's are starting to affect the way a person goes about their daily life, if you can give them just that little bit more freedom of movement or confidence in movement, they're going to be a lot more likely to go out and participate in everything that life has to offer, as opposed to the other end of the spectrum, which is, you know, you find that people ever so slowly will go, oh, well, I don't feel too safe on my feet anymore, so I better not go on that walk that I always do with my friends every Friday. And then very slowly it just catches up because, you know, after the age of 30, no matter what, whether you've got neurodegenerative disorder or if you've got, well, the neurodegenerative disorder that is life, it's all about lose it, use it or lose it. So arguably starting medications earlier when the symptoms are bothering them actually confers a better prognosis to people, at least in the short to medium term.
Right. So we're starting levodopa early.
Yeah.
Are we just starting with a little bit of Sinemet or Matterpar? Does it really matter? Low dose, high dose, medium dose?
So, well, it really just comes down to the person. So just a quick note on the different medications that we have at our disposal. So levodopa is, as I said, a prodrug of dopamine, which is the neurotransmitter that people can no longer produce or can't produce in adequate amounts in Parkinson's disease. This is the first drug that was found, and it's still, all I think about 40, 50 years on, it's still the best in terms of bang for buck for dose to clinical effect. So it's still the best in terms of getting a motor improvement. It's always coupled with a decarboxylase inhibitor, or either benzazide or carbidopa, just so that you, because it tends to be broken down in the guts, that just prevents it being broken down in the guts and saving more levodopa for the brain. We've got a few other agents as well. There's dopamine agonists, which act on the postsynaptic dopamine receptor. So they're the pramipexole and rutigotine are the best known ones. There are MAO-B inhibitors, for example, risagiline and selegiline, that prevent the breakdown of synaptic dopamine. There's amantadine, otherwise known as Simitril. We don't quite know what it does, but it does good things. It's the motor function, but we use it very specifically in cases where people have troublesome dyskinesias. And then we've also got anticholinergics such as benztropine and trihexyphenidyl, which are reasonable for tremor, but they've got so many anticholinergic side effects that they're, you know, I think I've used them about twice in the last 7 to 10 years because of those troublesome side effects. So yes, which do we start? It really is patient and doctor dependent. So As far as doctors go, I guess it's the same with any drugs or any medication. You tend to use what you're comfortable with, you know, and that you know that works quite well. As far as patient suiting it to the patient goes, the usual considerations come into play. So first things first, you need to know that none of these medications are curing, then they're symptomatic management. So the best dosing frequency and dose will be entirely dependent on that particular person's physiology at that point in time. So that's something to take into consideration. The next thing is whether or not there's someone who is highly unlikely to take a tablet 3 to 4 times a day, or if they just prefer to take once a day. So these are the things to think about, and you can tailor medications to those needs. Me, personally, my preference is to start levodopa 3 times a day, so at 50 milligrams. So it can be any of the brand names, it doesn't matter, Cinnamit or
Matapar.
All of those ones. Cinnamit, Kinsen, of course, and Matapar too. So I like to start at about 50 milligrams per day. You take it half an hour before brekkie, half an hour before lunch, half an hour before dinner, and then gradually sort of every 2 to 4 weeks, depending on side effects and how the person is feeling, I'd go up by 50 milligrams per dosing point. So starting at a 50 TDS, 100 TDS, and if need be, 150 and 200, and see how we go with that.
Right. So that's totally doable. So we'll start a little bit of levodopa, 50 milligrams TDS, and then increase that after a few weeks by 50 milligrams.
Yeah.
Now, what are the most common side effects that we need to be looking out for, Kim?
So as far as levodopa goes, the usuals are nausea, which actually not too many people get, but when people do get it, it can be just awful. That's an effect that happens whenever we increase the dose of the medication in general as well. So the way to get around that should not be, I guess it's something definitely that I warn people about. But it should not be a reason to stop the medication altogether. So we just use our workarounds there. So I'll often prescribe domperidone as well. And people can fill that script or not. You just take domperidone 10 milligrams with each dose of medication or just prior to your levodopa dosing. Do that for the first couple of weeks and then go to PRN after that. Other workarounds are taking the tablets with food, which of course, you know, sends off alarm bells, but you're not supposed to take levodopa with your meals. At the beginning of that is true, because protein will slow down the absorption of levodopa, a protein meal in the guts as well. But really, that's only necessary to be stringent about as you get to more moderately to advanced Parkinson's disease. Early on in the condition, you've still got enough reserves. Your brain can make enough to compensate for that. So they're the key ones. The other side effects to look out for that I warn people about are worsening constipation. That's probably the one that I see the most, because both Parkinson's disease can cause constipation, but also levodopa causes it too. Of course, that's not a reason to stop the medication. And in fact, it's a good trigger to start talking about bowels, because there will be so much chat about bowels for the rest of the therapeutic relationship. And I warn people about that. Talk about bowels because it's so important, because it's, you know, as I said, it's something that happens due to Parkinson's disease. It's something that the medications do. And on top of that, if you are constipated, it feels awful, but then the next step later on in sort of moderately advanced Parkinson's disease, constipation can very much so affect the absorption of levodopa as well. So it's something that we just start talking about and getting okay with talking about early on. They're the key ones. I also warn people that they could get hallucinations, though if they do, definitely that's a reason to stop the medications, and I will ask people to either contact our Parkinson's nurse or see their GP or just stop the medications if it's at a very low dose already. Because if someone's developing hallucinations in what you think is early Parkinson's disease, then it's probably not early Parkinson's disease. Hallucinations and levodopa come about only if you've got some dementia on board as well.
Kim, should we expect all of our patients to respond with the levodopa in terms of their tremor as soon as they have their medication, even if we need to titrate it up?
Yeah, actually, that's a very good point. So a couple of things to take from that is, so number one, thinking it's important to talk with people about what the expectations or the expected outcomes are from taking levodopa, like what constitutes treatment success, what are we aiming for, and therefore how do we know when we've reached an adequate dose for that person? You know, is it 50 milligrams TDS, 100, 200, etc., etc.? So One thing that's very important to for the practitioner to know, but particularly to convey to the person who with Parkinson's, is that levodopa, and in fact all of the agents that I've mentioned, are very effective for rigidity and bradykinesia, but less so for tremor. So the sort of quoted figure is it'll only work in about 50% of people for adequate tremor reduction. In my practice, I've noticed that it can actually work very nicely for tremor, but you're just going to get on cracking doses to the point of being excessive. So it's important very early on to say to negotiate with your patient about what treatment outcomes they want and how also to be realistic in those goals. So yes, you can get to reduction of tremor, but it's often way too high, and rigidity and bradykinesia have already been treated at lower doses. And that's when, so thinking about what I said earlier about this old thinking that levodopa used to be, used to accelerate the disease. There is some truth to that, in that though the studies which made us think that were based on giving patients doses of levodopa that are way in excess of what current prescribing practices are now. So mm-hmm. In fact, the nuance to that rule that levodopa is not harmful, sort of the caveat is as long as you are at the lowest appropriate dose for that person's symptoms. Because if you are at excessive doses very early on for a long period of time, then we do know from those earlier studies that people are more likely to progress to motor fluctuations earlier.
Right. So we're, I wouldn't say aggressive, I'll say enthusiastic with our medicating, Kim, and making sure our patients are adequately educated. Yes. What else can we do for our patients?
So, yeah, we've talked a lot about medications because that's, I guess, such a straightforward thing to do. But in fact, if we're thinking about early on in the diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, there's so much more that we can do. And if you just frame it in terms of what you do for anyone with a chronic condition at the early stages post-diagnosis, number one is education. This isn't a condition that's going to go away, and unfortunately that we can't cure. You may not be their GP forever. I may not be their neurologist forever. But the one person that's going to be with them through this, you know, with this disease process forever is themselves. So education, education, education. And I'll do one-on-one education with the person with Parkinson's. If their partner or significant other's there as well, then we do a bit of education as well. I have my own little Parkinson's on one piece of paper handout that I've created. Yeah. I'm gradually perfecting over the years, and then I direct them towards particular websites as well. So Parkinson's Australia, the Michael J. Fox Foundation is also really good too. And then encouraging people if they want, you know, to talk with local support groups as well. There's so many options. But the key is letting them know that this is, you know, I think the terminology is, you know, you need a patient-centered approach. Because this is a moving target over the years, this condition. Symptoms change in your head, and the treatment is symptomatic. It's not curative. It's entirely based on what you do as the doctor for people with Parkinson's is highly dependent on what they value and what they need, you know, what they need fixed or helped or adjusted in order to live their best lives. So that's it. So number one, education, education, education. Number two, I was saying that we have no disease modifying treatments or cures, but the closest thing we do have to that, in fact, is regular intensive exercise. So stacks and stacks and stacks of research being done on this over the last 10 to 15 years. Enough that you can do a few podcasts and then some. But I guess the overall feeling is that exercise should begin as soon as the diagnosis of Parkinson's is given. There's lots of different studies and meta-analyses and yada, yada, yada that you can look into. It can all get quite confusing, but the bottom line is start it early, and it doesn't, some studies would say it doesn't matter what kind of exercise, just get moving. But then when you get to the more nuanced pointy end of the studies, then some would suggest that regular high intensity aerobic exercise is beneficial not only for all the usual things like cardiovascular health and improved bone health, but also for both the motor symptoms of Parkinson's disease and quality of life outcomes. So I will, right from the outset, say even if you don't want to take medication, I want you to go out. I want you to figure out what kind of exercise you want to do and start it up. Now, that can be done either on their own. Some people are like individual forms of exercise, some like group, some like formalized exercise, some like just free form. We have an excellent Parkinson's disease rehabilitation program over at the private hospital. I'm not affiliated, but I do refer a lot of patients because that's a structured, and there's growing evidence for a structured Parkinson's disease rehabilitation and exercise program as well. But yes, so exercise, exercise, exercise. The other thing that is not quite applicable, well, it's applicable to Parkinson's disease, but more so for prevention of dementia. So a lot of this research has been done more in the Alzheimer's dementia space. But I encourage everyone to do regular, challenging mental exercises as well. So by that, I mean finding a skill that they've always wanted to learn. It doesn't matter what it is. You know, it can be knitting, it can be painting, it can be learning a language, learning an instrument, and doing it. Just learn it, because the idea is to get into this stage when in the early phases of learning any new skill is to get into that stage or that phase of what's called optimal frustration. Because it's in that stage, you know, optimal frustration in my definition is you're finding this new skill frustrating. Can't do it. I can't do it. I want to do it better. But it's not so frustrating that you want to give it up altogether and not go back to it. So it's that nice little middle stage where you just determine to get better. And the correlate on it at a neurological level is that you've got neurons that are forming connections. And what you're doing is you're future-proofing your brain, particularly against dementing illnesses. So that's the other thing that I recommend to people do, is to find something, find a skill, a new hobby, something like that, and do it. The usual frequent I get is, oh, cryptic crosswords. I do cryptic crosswords, so I'm challenging my brain. And then you've got to quickly quit back. But how many years have you been doing that for? Oh, 20. Well, it's not challenging for you anymore. You've got to find something else. That's the key.
Right. So we're starting our levodopa early, Kim. We know that it's going to be really good at helping with rigidity and bradykinesia, but maybe not so good at treating tremor in the early doses. We need to be educating our patients about the potential side effects and making sure we manage the nausea and constipation and hallucinations or dyskinesias as appropriate. But we can be modifying the progression of the disease with regular intensive activity and also those mental activities. So, yes, you've given up on cryptic crosswords, but I'm going to stick with Duolingo at least for a little bit longer. Now, Kim, when do we involve our allied health partners in our Parkinson's management?
Yes, as early as is required. So what that really boils down to is what symptoms your patient is exhibiting, what's causing problems, and then can that issue be addressed by an allied health practitioner. So the typical ones are, so if we think about the other features of Parkinson's disease, not the cardinal features, but the fuller spectrum of Parkinson's disease. We also know that people develop dysarthria, difficulty, it's a hypophonic dysarthria, so softly spoken, that gets worse with fatigue at the end of the day. So speech pathology for that, and our speech pathologists, I have a lot to do with, not just because of the dysarthria, but also because dysphagia, the G, develops in Parkinson's disease as well and gets gradually worse over time. And in fact, dysphagia leading to aspiration pneumonia is one of the major causes of morbidity and mortality in people with Parkinson's disease. So if we're talking about early on in Parkinson's disease, probably don't need them. And in the first 7 years or so, I'll just, you know, do little screening questions with people, you know, any difficulties with swallowing, are you the last one at the table finishing up your meal? Does it take a little while to take that first gulp of food? If the answer is yes to any of those, then I'll send someone off for a speech pathology review earlier rather than later. Once they're in the system, though, with a good speech pathologist, then your role as the practitioner is really just to check that that's still going on. But speech pathologists who are experienced with Parkinson's will have a good idea of when to follow patients up and will ensure that that follow-up schedule occurs. Other allied health, of course, you know, if everyone's following my advice and doing exercise, then they'll see a physiotherapist. That's really only very early on. If people want to do Parkinson's disease specific exercises, but also I'd be referring early if they have any kind of difficulty with their gait. Parkinson's disease, of course, affects your ability to walk and also your postural reflexes, your ability to catch yourself if you're falling. And we can modify those to a certain extent with medications and physiotherapy. But there's other things that we don't want to get too singly minded. Just because someone has Parkinson's disease doesn't mean they can't have difficulties with walking for other reasons. And we know that in order to walk, you need to be able to feel your feet on the ground. So you need to be able to be strong in your legs. You need to have core strength. You need to be able to see. You need to be able to think. So a good all-rounder physiotherapist for gait and balance is a really good idea early on if you flagged any of those other issues as something that will potentially make this person fall earlier than is expected. So that's physiotherapy. Occupational therapy around the house, practicalities, that's probably a bit later on in the condition. Mental health is something that is a big and not as big part of Parkinson's disease. 30% of people will, as a part of the condition itself, will develop anxiety and or depression. And it's not just an adjustment. It's not an adjustment disorder. Breathing, the natural breathing at finding out this kind of diagnosis, it's a process that's inherent to the condition. So I will educate people early on, but if it's a tough group to convince to go and see a psychologist, maybe the next generation will be a bit more okay with it. But I will, if there's definitely mental health concerns that are impacting this person's ability, I guess, to get out and, number one, enjoy their life, but number two, to partake in treatments that will improve their lot as far as Parkinson's symptoms goes, then early referral to a psychologist is also worthwhile.
Okay, so Kim, if I have a patient who's been really well managed on their medication and now things seem to be progressing, the medications don't seem to be working, what are our options to manage those patients?
All righty, this does happen. So number one, you've got to think about it in the context of where they are in their condition is number one. Are they sort of early? Are they in that first 7 years, that honeymoon period where the medications just do beautifully? They don't notice if they haven't taken one, and there are no motor fluctuations. Or are we getting towards the end of the more moderate to severely advanced Parkinson's, which is characterized by motor fluctuations between dyskinesias and off periods and on periods, with a dominance as well of troublesome non-motor symptoms. So I guess number one, you've got to sort of frame the person that's in front of you and ask the question, is it expected or not that the medications aren't doing their trick? And if the answer is yes, it's expected, then you can go along with the usual pathway of looking at things from a simple point of view first. So if someone, for instance, is saying that their medications just aren't giving them the right bang for the buck, you know, they feel like the medications kick in but not as strongly as they used to, maybe they're wearing off a bit more earlier before the next dose, or maybe sometimes there are complete dosing failures, then the simplest things first, make sure that you're taking tablets half an hour before food and make sure that people aren't constipated. And sometimes, believe it or not, like in a not insignificant proportion of people, just those simple moves can really help the boost the absorption of what they're taking already and alleviates the need to jump straight to a higher dose. So that's number one. And yeah, check that they are taking them at the time. So you've got written down in front of you as well. There can be like these, you know, people with Parkinson's, again, as I said before, just because you've got Parkinson's doesn't mean you can't have other conditions. So, and, you know, other conditions will also have other medications associated with them, and it can get very confusing. So a medication review if you suspect that maybe everything's getting a bit mixed up. If you feel like all that's been satisfied and really it is just that the disease is progressing and their ability to produce dopamine is dropping, and so we have to replace with more exogenous dopamine, again, it's a decision based on what suits that patient. I can barely remember to take my vitamin tablets in the morning. So taking a tablet 3 times a day and boosting up to 4 times a day would be a big, it just wouldn't happen. So I tend to say to people, okay, so if we're having early wearing off of your medications, you know, an hour away from the next dose, and you feel like you're developing off symptoms again, then I say, look, we can either give you the same dose but more frequently, or we can increase the dose of levodopa at any point in time. The thing to know about increasing the dose at any point in time is that you put yourself, because you're going to be increasing the peak dose in the blood of dopamine, that you are more at risk of symptoms of dopamine excess. So dyskinesias, those excessive wriggly movements, as well as postural hypotension. So just warning people about that, and usually that's enough. And then that can do the trick. If you just go from, say, 150 TDS up to 200 TDS, that can time people over for a lot longer. There are other options as well. You can either add in entacapone, so a COMT inhibitor. There's a newer version of that, which is a once-daily medication called opicapone, that just basically increases the bioavailability and duration of effect of levodopa in the system. That can work very nicely too. Though some would say you should probably decrease the dose of levodopa with every dose of entacapone as well, just to avoid those peak dose effects. So there's that. So you can either increase the dose, increase the frequency, add in entacapone or opicapone. The other thing is you can add in something like prasugrel, which is a once daily medication, an AOB inhibitor. It doesn't give you too much of a benefit, but for some people who are only just starting to wear off, it can just increase the bioavailability of dopamine just a little bit more. It's also helpful. A lot of these medications will use for their beneficial side effects too. So some would say that, you know, if someone's got some difficulties with motivation and they're not too happy but not clinically depressed, then a prasugrel can help as well. Patches also, so you can add in patches with a dopamine agonist for roupinirol, or you can give once daily pramipexole as well.
Yeah, that's so helpful, isn't it? What about the patients, Kim, who have significant motor symptoms overnight? That can be really challenging.
Absolutely. So motor symptoms, and as far as difficulty rolling in bed, can cause a lot of difficulties. So the most obvious one is that they wake up feeling stiff and sore and take a bit longer to get started in the morning. But then there can be the more subtle manifestations of motor dysfunction at nighttime, whereby they're not waking up completely to roll to a new position in bed, but it disturbs them enough to come out of the deeper phases of sleep. And so they're, even though they're technically asleep the whole night, it's not the deeper restorative phases of sleep. And so people can complain of not feeling, you know, just feeling increasingly lacking in refreshment in the morning, like waking up not feeling like they've had a good sleep. Alternately, people can wake up throughout the night with nocturia, which you may think we know that nocturia can happen in Parkinson's disease as well, just it's through distress or instability. But also, if you're not getting into the deeper phases of sleep because if you're not able to move well, and so you're having these micro arousals throughout the night to shift position, and you're not getting into the deeper phases of sleep, you're not producing adequate antidiuretic hormone, and so you're making wee when you shouldn't, and then you get up, you go to the toilet, and then what is it that these people will say to their GPs? I get up in the middle of the night to go and do a wee. So A lot of that can come under the banner of motor dysfunction at night. So what can we do about it? Slow release, levodopa is usually the best way. So that's your either Manipar HPS or Sinemet CR. And what that is that it's a low and slow release. It's a medication formulation that is best and should only be used at nighttime. It's tempting to use it during the day, just on the surface. Oh, slow release medication. In fact, it's not useful at all because of the it's you get a lot less bang for buck. You don't get the peak dose concentration, and it lasts way too long. So we just use that overnight when the dopamine requirements are a little bit less, but you just need a bit in the tank to get a good sleep. And so that's what we can use for that. Some would also say patches of some slow release dopamine agonist, the pramipexole, or you can use a rouquinolone patch as well.
And then for the patients who get those really awful choreiform dyskinesias, Kim, how are we best managing those patients?
By asking them whether or not the dyskinesias bother them, because more often than not, they don't. People would prefer to be dyskinetic and be on rather than being not dyskinetic and off, which is at the stage of Parkinson's at which dyskinesias do become prominent. That's really, unfortunately, what the choice often comes down to. So if someone has got dyskinesia, you can ask them if it bothers them. If it doesn't bother them and you don't think they're overdosed otherwise, then you leave it be. If it does bother them, though, there's two options. You can decrease your levodopa dose, but that, of course, comes at the cost of being more likely to be off and to experience off symptoms. Alternately, one medication that can help quite nicely is amantadine, and it's a 100 milligram tablet. You take it or casually take it first thing in the morning, and the dose can be up to another 100 milligrams at lunchtime. In theory, it shouldn't be taken at night because it can, in theory, keep people awake. And it works really nicely. Again, it's not like all the other adjunct medications. It doesn't have as much bang for buck as levodopa as far as improving rigidity and bradykinesia, but it's got a bit, and at the same time it tends to take the edge off the dyskinesias. So that's one I commonly prescribe. It's one that I have to deprescribe later on, though, because it's got anticholinergic side effects. So if someone's progressing towards dementia, then that's one of the, and is developing hallucinations, then that's one that we have to taper back fairly early on.
Oh, Dr. Kim Forrest, public neurologist in the Cairns region, you've given us an enormous amount of information today about Parkinson's, not least importantly to remember the 7-year honeymoon period, which of course I have forgotten since medical school. Dr. Kim Forrest, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
For more information about the Roundup or to share your feedback and ideas for future episodes, visit nqrth.edu.au/roundup-podcast or contact us at nqrth.mackay@jcu.edu.au. We also want to advise that the views and opinions presented in this podcast are those of the speaker only and do not represent the views and opinions of James Cook University, Northern Queensland Regional Training Hubs, or Queensland Health. The content supplied in this podcast is not intended as medical advice and is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Northern Queensland Regional Training Hubs is an initiative of the Australian Government's Integrated Rural Training Pipeline and is facilitated by James Cook University in partnership with public and private hospitals, Queensland Aboriginal and Islander Health Council, health services, Aboriginal community-controlled health organisations, and general practice clinics.